Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new bonus episode of Oh My Word podcast. We have an extremely, extremely special treat for all you lucky listeners today because we have with us someone. Her name is Becky Spratford, and the first thing you need to know about her is that she's Kelly Power's friend. So if everyone remembers our interview that we did with Kelly a couple weeks ago, that also you want to listen to again after you finish listening to this. So Kelly said, hey, speak with Becky. And we said, we absolutely will. And here we are. So Becky is a reader's advisor in Illinois. And she'll tell us what that is. So don't forget that if you don't know. And she trains library staff all over the world on how to match books with readers through the local public library. So hello, Becky. Welcome to our program.
Hi, Esther. Thanks for having me. And I do adore Kelly. She is great people. So.
We agree. We love Kelly. she's great. So just, I don't know if you want to add a little bit more to what I said about you, but if you can please tell everyone what does it mean to be a reader's advisor?
Yeah, sure. So basically what I tell people who don't know, it's most people know what reference librarians do, right? You ask them a question, they look up the answer. Well, reader's advisory is basically leisure reading reference. Yes, our job is to help you when you come in, instead of for your needs, you have a question that needs answering, but for your wants, the things you want to do. And I say reading, but in public libraries, that word actually means watching, listening, reading. It's all the things you would do in your free time for fun at the library. There are staff who are trained to help match you based on your likes with something else you may like. So that, of course, then leads you to all these other places. And there are professional staff, like reference librarians, who do that with a capital L, like readers advisory librarians. But there are also, if this readers advisory is a thing that's done all over a library building. I have a blog called RA for All, and it's readers advisory for all. And it's been going since August of 2007. And it began really when I was teaching the readers advisory course at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science. Yes, we need a master's degree to do this. I went to that school, but then I taught that class for 8 years, actually, as an adjunct faculty member. And I realized there was so much material that I was creating and my students were creating that I wanted to share. And in the meantime, I've spun it off into leading the library I worked at to being a consultant full time. And I go into libraries and train every member of the library staff, literally from the janitor to the director, on how to engage patrons with your collections and by sharing what you love to read or watch or do, and how we pass those on and suggest and have conversations around books and movies and audiobooks and all that. So that's basically what it is. It's super fun, by the way.
You're saying basically, and it sounds like it covers basically everything, which isn't so basic.
It is. It's like everything. I like to say that Reader's Advisory is like the heart of the library, right? When people think about the library, they think about books. Even if they're not using it for books, it's what people have been asking for, like with our buildings being closed right now with the coronavirus quarantine.
Right.
They're like getting all the books. Like we started curbside at my library. The building's not open, but we got to get the books to people and the online books and the, like, people love library with books, and it's the dream of all people that go to work at the library. You think you're going to spend your whole day reading books, and you don't. But if your job is to suggest them, and it can be really anyone's job in the building because it's the core of what we do. So it's everything, but it's also like I always like to say, like my heart, you know, like it's all the best parts. It's not unclogging the copier and cleaning up the clogged toilet, which is what you actually do when you work in the library.
Well, also because that you mentioned reading all day, and this is a little bit of a side question, but how many books do you actually read per week, or how much do you have to read versus just being familiar and being able to recognize titles?
You know what? I'm going to give you some props, Esther, because that question is one that you have asked on your own without, dear listener, no prompting for me. But that is one that I have to drill home to library workers. They freak out about the number of books they read and are they reading enough? And like battling each other over who can read more. But really, I have this thing on my blog, Ari for All, the 10 Basic Rules of Reader's Advisory, which is its own page, which you can go look at. And one of the rules is it's more important to read about books than it is to read them cover to cover. You're absolutely right. It's about being familiar. Another one of my rules is to use resources. Library workers often don't let themselves use resources for reader's advisory. They do for reference, but they think it has to all come from their knowledge.
Right.
And I train so much about how to be aware of books. So we talk at length about it's not as important about how many you personally read. It's how many you know about, whether that's because you're talking as an entire staff and sharing books with each other. Or my favorite tip and trick that I tell all library workers to do is to go to Goodreads, because you can go to Goodreads. You know, we have access to all the professional journals. I write for Booklist. I do reviews. I do reviews and content for Library Journal. I mean, there's professional content we can access, all right? But we need to know what readers think. So
right.
I send people to Goodreads, and I tell librarians, like, you got Goodreads open. Look up any title, right? Search a keyword. And then go look at the 5-star and the 2-star reviews for those books and see what an actual reader says about those books. What did they love about it and why? What did they not like about it and why? Sometimes you learn a lot about why someone would like a book from the person who didn't like it, right? Sometimes they don't like it because there were too many narrators, right? There was too many points of view.
Right.
But you have another reader who's like, oh, I hate when there's only one point of view. So, well, then this book's perfect for you, right?
Yeah.
So... But that's where we can see and get access to more readers and learn from each other. So, yes, it's exactly right. Readers' advisors need to know about as many books as possible, but most importantly, not about the actual books, but where to find information about them. So if you have a reader who likes science fiction, that you know what resources to go to look for them. Maybe you know someone on staff who's a big science fiction fan. Maybe you know which resources, right? They like just speculative in general. One of my favorite places to send them is the Locus recommended reading list, right? And there's lots of good resources. I have so many lists of them that I give to librarians. There's ways to search for them. That's really, you know, getting way too much behind the scenes on how we do
yeah.
it. But it's really important, exactly what you said, to know about as many types of books and where to find them and how to find new voices too.
Right, that's true. Well, it's interesting. It's interesting that you said that you look at, for Goodreads, that you look at 2 stars and 5 stars. I've learned to use Goodreads a lot before when I'm looking into books. And I tend to look at the 3 and 4 star ones, because sometimes 5 star, I feel like it's a little too fan. Like, I feel like I might not get an honest take on it because someone might just, whatever the writer writes, they just love them, versus a 4-star means this is a good read, but here's why I didn't think it was perfect. And that sometimes I feel like gives me a more realistic picture. So I wonder why you chose 2 and 5.
At all of them.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
All the reviews. I just give you're absolutely right. I think the 1 stars are the only ones I just miss outright. I've literally seen, like, there was like the name of the main character was the same name as my childhood nemesis. This book is dead to me.
Oh.
Like, that's not how many.
Yeah.
You know, no, I agree. I actually look at all the reviews.
Okay.
And I love the nuances. And I really do like when it's people who really talk about why they liked the book.
Yeah.
And don't spend a lot of time on plot. That's another thing we talk about. The way we match books with readers in the reader's advisory world is by using these things we call appeal terms. But what they are actually just the adjectives that describe why you like the book. So they're about, like, the pacing. Either it was compelling or it was methodically paced, right?
Right.
And all the terms
right.
are positive because we're not judgmental. Or
right.
It's about that it's character-centered, and what about the characters did you like? Or was it more storyline? Did it have twists? You know, where is the setting and what's the frame? What's the tone and mood? You know, how is it written? What's the style and language? This is what we talk about, the why someone likes the book, not what happens. And I have a series of exercises I actually make library workers go through with a book they love in mind and have them reconnect to the books that they love and why. And then they look at why they love it. And I say to them, now if you can understand why you like a book you like, you understand that it's not about what happened. It's about how it was told. And now you can better understand somebody else when they come to you and explain the books they like and why. Because readers talk in adjectives. They might not say it's compellingly paced with, you know, richly developed characters. You know, they might not use those kind of language.
Right.
If you listen to them, I like to use Dan Brown as an example. When people talk about Dan Brown in the library, because people love him, they say things like, you know, there's historical intrigue, there's puzzles to solve, there's exotic locations, there's an everyman hero, right?
Right.
Like, they don't start explaining the complicated plot to you.
Right.
And so when you understand why you love the books you love, then you can better understand why someone else loves the books they love, even if it's a genre you don't personally like. But you make that connection. And so that's how we do it. It's all about embracing everyone's individual enthusiasm for their favorite types of books.
Oh, that's very good. So how does, because we spoke with Kelly, and but Kelly's a school librarian, and
yes.
then you worked in a public library. So how do those roles, how are they either similar or where does it diverge? Because in a school, yeah. over time, you could develop relationships with the kids, or you have a much smaller group that you're dealing with. You can kind of get to know the people a little bit better. So how is that different or the same in a public library?
Yeah, so I also volunteer at the school library, so I can totally understand that. There are serious differences and serious similarities. So first of all, one of the big differences is in school library, everything you do really supports the curriculum.
Right.
And so you have like a much more narrow focus. In the public library, we literally can collect anything. And it's up to the people in the library organization who are the selectors who do collection development. I happen to do that also when I did Readers Advisory, but sometimes they're separated. So there's a lot about getting the right materials into your library to serve those people you're serving. So it's a double-edged thing where the Readers Advisory people and the collection development have to work together to make sure you have the books you want to suggest.
Right.
But here's the thing. Libraries have regulars. I had the people that came in all the time. I had the people that went to my book clubs. They were the people who came up to the desk, who were there weekly, monthly, daily, who we interacted with. And we got to learn about what they liked and didn't like. So there's those. Those we were actively helping with our Readers Advisory. But they are not even close to the majority of the people that we're serving.
Right.
The vast majority of the people we are serving, whereas in a school library, it's almost all hands-on active Readers Advisory. In a public library setting, there's a lot of passive Readers Advisory. And passive doesn't mean I'm not doing anything, but it means that I'm putting things out there for people. So we're doing Goodreads shelves that we put on our, like, so our patrons can see what we're reading. We have displays either online or in the building. We have lists of books. If you like this, you might like this. We're creating content. We're retweeting or posting things we see other places. We're letting people know about book award winners. There's so much we're doing to just sort of put that information out there, and hopefully people see it and come back. And the way we know that is, then, did we make a display on this? Did we do a list on this? Are those books getting checked out? How many hits did that list have?
Right.
Are people checking them out? Should we get more? Is this, you know, I work a lot promoting horror. That's my specialty. I am also the secretary of the Horror Writers Association, because I am a professional horror writer also, because I write fiction. Good to all you who do. I have no plans to do that. I write textbooks about horror for librarians. I'm on my third one now that I'm writing. So that's my specialty. So I'm often pushing horror. I have an entire hashtag that I've created on Twitter that other libraries use now, hashtag horror for libraries, because I'm trying to identify the titles I think will work in libraries for readers. And it's not just the content. A lot of times libraries have restrictions on where and how they can order things. And so, like, getting self-published titles is difficult without reviews.
Okay.
If I am able to find if it gets into my hands and I'm able to review it in a journal or even on my horror blog, a lot of libraries count that as a professional review.
Okay.
Because I am trusted. But I can't, you know, I have to review the Josh Malerman's and the Stephen Graham Jones's and the Sylvia Moreno Garcia books that are coming out, you know, in the next month. But I try to throw in some smaller presses, too. I'm limited because there's certain books I have to make sure get reviewed. And libraries are going to buy and need a review to help them sell it to people. There's a lot of passive work. And you'd be surprised how many people, especially when you're working with adults, which I mostly work with teens and adults, prefer that interaction. They prefer it on their own terms. And they will contact you. Some libraries do things like online reading forms, so you tell them what you like to read and they send them back to you. You know, there's email chat, there's There's Facebook Readers Advisory that libraries do. There's Twitter chats. There's lots of ways to do it.
Right.
And we all try to work together. And then, as I mentioned, I write for Booklist, which is published by the American Library Association, and Library Journal, which are two of the biggest review journals in the library world and in the publishing world. When I give something a star in Booklist, like I saw one time a Joe Hill, an ad for a Joe Hill book, and it was like the top of the full page ad was, you know, a quote from my review.
Now, oh, wow.
My name on it.
Oh, wow.
It says Booklist star review. Yeah. But right. It says Booklist star review because that's how we do it. We don't individually name the reviewers.
Right.
And that's fine. But I get super excited. You know, like, it's important what I do. It gets the word out. But we try to get material in those journals too, because that's what the library workers are using to promote. So it's a lot of behind the scenes work. I like to say, when I learned Readers Advisory, I was taught about it as a transactional service. Someone comes to the desk and asks you for a book, and you then say, okay, you like, you know, what else do you like to read and why? What are your other favorites? That's great. I think you would like this X, right?
Right.
And so that's what we do. We call those read-alikes, and we make connections. So, but that's not what it is. That's what it was when we were justifying giving money to it as its own department. It is now conversational. Huh. It is about the conversations that we have with readers all the time, whether they're in front of us, they're in the building and overhearing us talking to each other, whether it's online, whether it's in our catalogs because we've added keywords or provided lists that, you know, the librarians have made, whether it's on Goodreads. Like, there's all these different ways that we do it, and they're not all active. Well, right. They're active. They're not all with the patron in front of you. They're active, but they're, you know, you're trying to reach the potential reader.
Right. Well, I don't know if you can answer this for most libraries, but how often does a library update their, I would say stock, but the books that are on the shelves? How often do you actually get a chance to update those? As in to buy new, to get new products?
Do you mean like what are on display or what we have in our vast stack?
To get in your stacks, how often can you get new titles?
Oh, no, we're ordering constantly. I mean, I was in charge of ordering. We're constantly ordering and constantly reading, right?
Right.
Public libraries are not libraries of record.
Okay.
We are trying to keep the most current collection that is of interest to our readers. Yes, we have some classics, but, you know, we're trying to be responsive to our community's needs and to provide them with a diverse picture of all the books that are available, right? Both diverse in terms of genre and in terms of who's writing the books, because, you know, books are a way to explore the world around you.
Right.
So, no, we are putting in orders usually monthly, usually libraries. So the way it works is libraries have selectors, okay? Now, they all do it differently. Like I said, some have centralized collection development departments, and some have selectors by genre, right?
Right.
So let's just say, for argument's sake, I am the library science fiction, fantasy, and horror buyer. And I worked at a fairly large library, one branch, but fairly large, right outside the Chicago city limits. And I had a fairly good budget. And I was ordering probably like 20 a month.
Wow.
Science fiction, fantasy, and horror. At a large library. Now, some libraries, it's much smaller. But I was also supervising the ordering of all the adult fiction and all the teen fiction. So there are different selectors throughout the building who have different either Dewey Decimal areas if it's nonfiction,
right,
or different genres if it's fiction. And then they go to a centralized, most libraries use Baker & Taylor or Ingram, and they create a cart and they put them in. And then the whoever's supervising the overall purchase is putting those all together, checking for duplicates, right, making sure we're within budgets, sending it back to the selector if they spent too much,
right?
You need to make a cut or move these to another month. And we're normally ordering at least 3 months in advance. So if your book, that's one of the things I work with indie publishers. It's very hard to, and I understand the barriers. Like, indie publishers aren't telling people until about a month before the book comes out that it's coming out.
Right.
It's often too late for the library to add it. And, you know, because the cart already went through, and then by the time the next cart is going through, the book's already out, and is it worth buying? There's all these other books that are coming out. I need to spend my money. If nobody actually asks for a book that's already out, the chance of it getting in is slim. Like, if a patron requests, that's the other thing, by the way, almost every library has on its website, a place where a patron, a local library patron, you have to provide your library card. Right. So it's not just an author spamming every library, asks for a book to be added. And they don't always automatically add every book, but they will look at it more if there's been a request to right. add it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that's why it's
yeah.
hard to buy books from like Amazon or something, because some libraries are unable to just go and buy whatever they want. It has to be available in Ingram, the Baker & Taylor. It has to be reviewed. There's like a lot going on with the bureaucracy. Shocking, right? It's a
yeah.
institution.
Yeah.
But we have those hurdles that we try to get over also. And libraries are being better about that now. So that's good.
So you actually, before we got, when we were talking originally, you told me something interesting about how library patrons actually spend more money on books. Which I don't know if a lot of people would think about that because sure. you think they're going to the library because they're not spending money on books.
Sure. So there's been many studies that say and that prove, and I'm actually on the I'm on the advisory committee for the Panorama Project, which is a large national group, and I present it for them at national conferences. It's trying to prove that publishers, that when libraries buy books, it makes publishers more money. And so there, you can go look up Panorama Project on your own, and I am on the Readers Advisory Council for that. But the studies show that people who are regular library users, and by regular library users, they count that as more than 4 visits a year. So okay. for people who go to the library more than 4 times a year, they, on average, spend more money buying books than someone who does not use the library. And when you really think about that, it makes sense, right? These are people that value books
right.
and value reading and would then also go buy books. And the thing we see then, that and that's proof, that's, there's studies that show that, but on the anecdotal side, I see it in the library. When somebody discovers an author at the library, they, right. especially genre readers, they go and then buy everything that person's ever written.
Oh, very good.
You know, and they get excited that they found that person. This is why I tell libraries that, especially in the speculative genres, anthologies are a great use of your money. I try to review in each of my, I have 4 Library Journal horror columns a year. I try to have 1 anthology in every single column, if I can help it, because anthologies are a great way for you to put a book out on the shelf. And readers can decide which authors they like. And then they're going to come and tell you, hey, I need more by this person.
Right.
That's how I learned who Stephen Graham Jones was. And now he has one of the hottest books of the year coming out. Like wow. that, because of anthologies. You know, and I my first story by him, I read it in an anthology. And then I started buying more of his books. And I had other patrons who read his stories, because he was often in Ellen Datlow's anthologies, who just loved him and asked for his books. And those were books that were harder to get, but we were able to go get them because people really liked the way he wrote. So it's really important that we think about that and consider that too.
Right. And now, just because you mentioned it a few times that you do book reviews, so when you are going to review a book, how do you approach that? What do you, first, how are you deciding what you're going to review? And then what are you looking for when you do the review?
Sure. So there's 2 ways to do it. Now, I happen to be considered the library expert in the field of horror. So I have a lot more leeway than a lot of reviewers that review for those journals. So for most library journal and book list reviewers, they're assigned a title by their editor.
Okay.
And it's just sort of a crapshoot, right?
Right.
You don't even know what's going to happen. But for me, and I'm going to be quite honest, Library Journal does not pay for their general reviews. They pay me for a column because I'm a columnist. But Booklist pays people for each review. Now, Booklist reviews, Booklist is a not-for-profit, and they only provide positive reviews. The feeling around it is, they will still pay me if I don't think the book should be reviewed. And by okay. positive, they mean, can you think of, when you write this review, write the review to its best reader? Because they don't want to waste librarians' time. We're really, really busy with panning a book, right?
Okay.
Because then it's like, why did I just read this review? They're trying to help. Their goal is actually Readers Advisory and collection development. They want to provide you with the what to say to the book's best reader. So for them, it's a combination of me seeking out some smaller press titles that I can feature, that they trust me to do, and them assigning me things. So I just got assigned, I just reached out for the new John Langan collection that's coming out in a few months. I don't remember the title right now. And I said, hey, I want to review this. Can you give me a slot for it? And they're like, yes, we would love to do that.
Okay.
Because he's an author that they has had good reviews and good success, even though it's word hoard in a really tiny press this time. But often I just get a book in the mail like, hey, this, you want to review this? I'm like, sure, let me give it a try. I've never heard of it. For Library Journal, I am creating, it's the first ever, starting in 2020, horror column. And I am creating this column with an editor, and I have complete leeway on the column. And I normally pair it with something else also. So I usually do an interview with one of the authors that I have solicited. So I get paid for the column and for any extra work I do. And in that case, I'm trying to get a good sampling. So for those, it has to be coming out the time frame. Library review journals, again, I cannot stress this enough, do not like to include books that are already out. So my columns appear in January, April, June, and October. So like the Langan was a great example. I would have loved to have put it in the column, but it's coming out in September. Well, my book, it was too, they didn't have an arc for my June one, which had a deadline in April.
Right.
And it didn't have a, it's too late for my October column. So I'm putting it in book list. All right. So there's that. So I did have, for smaller presses, they do sometimes allow me, my last column, they let me put in two small press titles, but there was another story there that I'm not going to go into about why.
Right.
But they let me do it because they were small presses and already out. They made an error, and so they let me make good on it. So, but in the, I get to pick those. I'm trying to make sure I'm representing a diverse amount of voices, people of color, LGBTQ if it's available. I'm trying to make sure I have a diverse experience of the horror, from the gorier books to the tamer books. I'm just trying to make sure I'm representing the genre in 7 or 8 books. That's all I get. And
wow.
By the way, my reviews, I get 200 words max.
Oh, wow.
To tell you quickly what's going to happen in the book. I do a sentence or two on plot. I do two to four sentences then on the appeal. Well, 3 sentences on the appeal. Why you would like this book. What, you know, what is the feeling when you read it? And then I give read alikes. So, like, what, you know, recommend for fans of.
Oh, wow. So.
Yeah, and it's 200 words.
Wow. Well, how much of that, aside from that, you're looking, I guess, the diversity of voices, how much are you, you're not exactly looking for, is this a good book or not a good book? You're looking at what might be appealing within this book to a reader?
Yeah, so in my book list reviews, since they are not assigned to me, and they have to be positive. I'm not talking about what it means to me. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I'm talking about who the best reader of that book is. So I'm picking books that I feel like have the widest possible appeal for a general public library audience. And I know the type of reader, I'm telling you, the library worker, what type of reader to give this book to. Now, in my library journal column, I tend to pick books that I personally really liked.
Okay.
Although I have done books that I didn't necessarily love.
Right.
I know that patrons will.
Oh, very good. Well, because sometimes, well, going back to Goodreads, sometimes you read a review that says, oh, this is so typical, it just hit all the notes. But I guess if you're writing a positive review of that, you'd say, this is good for someone who just likes to read in the genre or something like that.
It's, yes.
Okay.
Yes. So it's interesting that because I do those professional reviews and I post them all on my blog. You can look at them. They're on both blogs, the regular and the horror blog. And the other thing is though that I do post my personal reviews, which I'm doing now, and I do those only on Goodreads. And I just provide a linked list on the blog. And I'm actually doing my second update of the year of the books I've read for fun.
Right.
And in there, I'm much more personal. Like in those, I'm like, you know, these are, so I do post my professional reviews on Goodreads too, but in there I'm like, I was just writing a review of Recursion, which is a science fiction book by Blake Crouch. And I talked about how the book made me feel and why I loved it and why, you know, it worked for me. Whereas if I were writing that review, that book came out in 2019. If I were writing that review for a profession for library workers, all of them, I would focus a lot on, how the story had like this super intricate thing about how time moved. It was like a big time loop on science fiction. And I would really explain what you need to tell readers because it's going to be confusing. And as long as they know it's confusing up front, they'll be less confused. And I'm going to need to articulate that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a totally random question. Are there certain classics or certain authors that readers just that just never get old. Not because, oh, it's a classic because it endures, but there's ones that everyone is always asking for X, even though there's so many new titles or there's so many new people out there. But for some reason, this person, everyone just... And then you have to steer them away from it. Yeah.
And I can't even because I am not a fan, personally. It's Jane Austen at the library. It's Jane Austen this. It's Jane Austen.
Wow.
You can tell by the books that are written that use it as frame, right? That use Jane Austen stories, like, and they're like a Pride and Prejudice type, you know, novel. Like,
right.
From all these different perspectives all over the world. And Dracula is one of those too.
Right.
But there's a lot of that. Actually, I just wrote my giant horror preview, which comes in the July issue of Library Journal, which is sort of just a quick overview of what's going on in the genre and what's coming out in the rest of the year. And I do that every year. And I have a little section about how many older things are coming back, like books that refer to Dracula or Frankenstein or, you know, all these different things in that their title. There's a series by I forget their names, but it's Stoker's Wild was the first one, and I'm about to review Stoker's Wild West. And it's going to be Bram Stoker and Oscar Wilde solve mysteries. And they're awesome.
Oh, wow.
Awesome. Library patrons eat them up. They're like the perfect book for library patrons because they're about books.
Ah, very good. Right.
Yeah.
Right. I have to ask, I asked Kelly, the answer was no to this, but I just have to ask, did you ever read Brandon Sanderson's Alcatraz versus the Evil Librarians?
No, I haven't, but I know about it.
Okay, good. Ever since I read that, I read the first one in the series, and I just couldn't stop laughing at how clever he was in the way he, like, twisted things. I just thought that was great. Anyway, so just
the one that librarians all really like is the Jasper Ford Thursday Next series.
Oh, okay. That's, I get my book recommendation. This is a bonus interview then. And just to, even though there was just so much to say on this, but just we're going to wrap it up a little bit here.
Yeah.
And I just want to finish off. I kind of warned you this was going to happen. If you could either fill in the blank or have an answer for what is something that either you can either answer for the publishing industry or for authors, what is something that you love to see them do? Like, I love it when they do X, or I love it when the books are X, or anything. And there can be anything between formatting, titles, covers, types of stories, anything. It's a very broad question, actually.
Yeah, so I'm going to be really self-serving here, and I love when authors make themselves available for libraries, when they add libraries to their press tours, when they Skype in with book clubs, when they will do a Q&A on, you know, YouTube or Facebook with libraries. I just love that, and the libraries, the authors I work with, who I've encouraged to do that, like, reach out to your local library and see, like, how you can work with them. Like, they are like, wow, that was, like, the best thing I ever did. Thank you for telling me to do that.
Wow.
I know, like, in this time with all these virtual book tours, there's an author, Alma Katsu, and her new book, The Deep, came out in April.
Right.
And she has been doing so many of her virtual tours. She's been including libraries. And she is on social media all the time about it and has talked to me about it. Like, how much more fun it is in the audience, like the participation. Like, they really, you don't get those questions like, well, how do I become a writer? What's the name of your agent? You get so much less.
Right.
Right. You get the, like, here's what I loved about your story. Hmm. You know, here's why I read your books. And I got to interview Gillian Flynn the week that Gone Girl went to number one live in person.
Oh, wow.
At my library. It was so cool. She lives in the Chicago area. We met through Karen Slaughter, the author, and she came. And literally, it was the week it went number one. We planned it way before. And if you go to the library I used to work at, it's the Berwyn Public Library, BERWYN, their YouTube page. This was so long ago. YouTube only let you do 15-minute videos with your free account.
Oh, wow.
So four 15-minute videos. We had so much fun.
Wow.
Like, and we did not get those questions. And so when authors share their time with libraries, when they don't think, oh, it's not going to make me any money because they're getting the books for free, you know what? Not only did we buy many copies at our library of Gone Girl, half the people in that audience either went out before and bought their own copy to get signed or bought it from the bookstore that we brought in to sell it.
Right.
Like, you know, and she made fans for life, and she just loved the experience. So I love it when authors include libraries in their book promotion plan.
Wow. Well, because it sounds like at the end of the day, especially with Reader's Advisory, you're the one putting the book into the reader's hand. If not, an author is just releasing a book out into the you know, into the ether, and who's going to catch that? You got to, either someone will or won't, versus if someone says specifically, you know, this, try this.
Yeah. And that personal connection means a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll just ask the flip side of that. Is there something either from the publishing industry or from authors or just book styles in general that you're like, can everyone please stop doing X?
That one's easy. Stop using the term guilty pleasure. I hate that term almost as much as I hate literary horror, literary thriller. Like, it's the opposite sides, right? The flip side of the coin.
Right.
Guilty pleasures, it is such a loaded term.
Right.
And it you are like, oh, it's my guilty pleasure. You know what? Horror is not my guilty pleasure. It's my profession. Like, it is great. And I'm not guilty about loving it. Okay.
Right. I'm sorry.
And I always tell my editor, I'm like, don't you ever dare put the word literary in front of my horror book. Like, literary horror. No, it's horror. Right. But you put literary in front of it, you're saying that all horror isn't literary and this one is. Like, it's the same when you say guilty pleasures. I'm done with guilty pleasures. Everybody has things that they like for the reasons they like it, and we do not need to explain why we like it, nor do we need to justify it. Life is too short to not have our fun and our pleasures. And reading is about fun.
That is so true. That is so great. I don't know. I want to end off on that, but if there's any last thing that you want to just throw in there for that everyone could pack in at the top of the suitcase, is there anything last thing that you'd like to throw in?
Yeah, you know, I do like to say to authors, don't just call your library and be like, here's my book, I live in the community, add it to the collection. And like, they can't just do that. Often the person you're talking to has no power to do that. But what you can do, and what libraries appreciate, is if you call your local library and say, hey, I'm a local author. Do you need help running a writer's group? Do you want me to, you know, do a presentation on writing? Do you want, like, is there something I can do for programming? And then say, do you have a local author shelf after you've worked with them? Because sometimes some libraries have like a place where if you give a copy, they can put it there.
Right.
And they promote their local author shelves. But here's the thing. Don't behave badly when you're talking to the library. Don't get huffy if they don't want to work with you, because we all talk to each other. We have this, like, I know here in Illinois, we have a list of like the authors that are fun to work with and the authors that nobody should work with of local authors, because they were nasty or mean. And, you know, there are some big name authors who are a pleasure to work with.
Right.
I used to actually work with Scott Turow at a law firm, and he is a fantastic human being. And Sonali Dev is a romance writer that lives here in the suburbs who has worked with me many times. But there are some people, and I'm not going to name them, who are absolute jerks. And some of them are very small time and some are big names. But you know what? Like, just try. Reach out. Libraries are looking for programming, especially now. Oh, my goodness.
Right.
Like, if you do research, like, I'm J.H. Moncrief is a Canadian. She writes, like, supernatural thrillers that are historic and usually set overseas.
Right.
She has made a cottage industry in Winnipeg where she lives going to the libraries. She does so much research for her fiction.
Wow.
She has, like, entire programs she gives about like haunted history in other places of the world based on her research.
Oh, wow.
And now her books are bestsellers in Winnipeg, and the libraries love them every time because she's made a name for herself as somebody who knows what she's talking about, and the libraries love her. And by the way, for some programs, if you have a really well put together one, libraries pay for that.
Oh, that's always a bonus.
Start off by offering for free, but then, right. You know, if you have like a PowerPoint you put together or like a thing like that you did research on, they'll pay you
right
to present. They have a budget for that.
Oh, wow. That's very good to know.
Okay, and if they ask, you say you charged $300. That's about the going rate, so I'm going to help you out there.
Oh, that is very, very good to know. Okay. All right, very good. Becky, thank you so much. It's such
You're
a pleasure
welcome.
To speak with you, and I'm so glad that we were able to squeeze ourselves into your schedule.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you guys contacted me. Thanks to Kelly.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly.
Woo!